Hello, White Sox fans, and welcome to another edition of the Future Sox Podcast. My name is Ian Eskridge. Joining me, as always, is Mr. James Fox. And as draft season is in full swing, tonight we have a special guest in D1 Baseball's Burke Granger. How you doing, Burke?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me on again.
Absolutely. It's always, you know, around draft time, you know, at least for, you know, James is a little bit more tapped in on this stuff than I am. And it's always great getting a bunch of different perspectives from, you know, guys who know way more about college baseball and the draft just in general than I do. So thanks for hopping on. How you doing,
well,
James?
The draft is a period of optimism where we can think about what's good might come. And there's not a lot of reason for optimism on the big club for the White Sox right now. So it allows us to get excited about what might be. So that's what this part of the year is all about.
Yep, for sure. How you doing, James? Everything good?
Yeah, I'm good. I was just like sending out tweets earlier about my hatred for the Pacers because I grew up in the 90s. And then Tyrese Halliburton like just tore his ACL. Am I a bad guy? I don't know. You know, like is it my fault?
Yes. I'm going to go yes on that.
Yes. Okay. That's fine. I'll live with it.
Yeah. I wasn't watching it all. I just was cruising on Twitter real quick, just checking some things. And I see tweets of Halliburton just laying on his belly. I was like, oh.
That is an Achilles tear. That's why you don't. You know, I know it's game seven, so this was never going to happen, but like playing with calf strains is not good.
Yeah, pretty terrible. So I guess we just kick this stuff off right away. So Burke, what is your opinion on what the strengths and weaknesses of the 2025 draft class?
So just off the top of my head, optically, like when you look at the draft boards that are posted publicly, you can make the argument that the high school class is a strength. Because last year we had like 14 of the top 15 picks were out of the college ranks, and that's not going to happen this year. So, and I say that with the caveat that, you know, I work for D1 baseball. I go to college baseball games every weekend. So I don't know much about the high school class. But just by default, I can say that, you know, I'm not as keen on this college class, and the high school guys are getting pushed up on mocks and public rankings that I'm seeing. So that's why I would say that they're potentially a strength. And then, you know, another way of saying that is for weaknesses. I think this college class is not as strong as what we've had the last 2 years, especially at the top. You know, there's like Paul Skeens and Dylan Cruz and Wyatt Langford from 23. That was the debate leading up to that day, and they're all in the bigs, you know. And in 24 you got Kurtz and Caglioni and Christian Moore are all in the bigs. Those were top 10 picks, and there was like three other position players that I think will be there soon. And you could say, like, I mean, maybe college shortstops, I think, is maybe a little bit of a strength in this one compared to last year. Because so last year there were three college shortstops picked in the first round, but J.J. Weatherholt and Seaver King and Colin Culpepper, like, none of them played shortstop all the way through their whole collegiate career. Seaver King didn't play at all last year at shortstop because Merrick Houston, one of my guys that I like better, is there. Whereas this year, you know, the shortstops, Merrick Houston has played shortstop his whole career. Aloy has played shortstop his whole career since he was a freshman. And then, you know, Gavin Keelan, in my opinion, is a no doubt shortstop. And then who's Ava Arquette, you know, is the big 6'5", 220-pound shortstop for Oregon State. And he's, in my opinion, you know, a top 10 pick and a potential shortstop, but the bat is what you like for him. But so you could say, just, you know, again, optically, that college shortstops, I like them in this class better than last year, because last year was kind of a wonky year with shortstops who didn't play shortstop all the way through their collegiate years getting drafted as shortstops. And then I did a recent check before we hopped on, and, you know, all of them are playing shortstop. The guys who got picked as shortstops last year are still playing shortstops. I haven't read scouting reports to see how that's playing out and how they're performing, though.
Yes, I mean, like, usually we see this, right, where, like, there's a lot of talk, right, and then the safe demographic kind of rises to the top where teams just want to take college bats if they can. Mm-hmm. But this year, right, and correct me if I'm wrong, like, you know, I think a lot of people feel like the top two guys are Iva Arquette and then Ike Irish, who probably won't catch but can hit and will play outfield. Those guys, to me, just – and look, you rank these players like for a living, right? So they seem more similar to me than to like your Cam Smiths and your, you know, you mentioned Seaver King, like that, those types of guys that usually go in the teens. These two guys might go, you know, in like the top 7 or 8 picks. Is that a fair assessment of this college class?
I'm right with you there. And in my, again, you know, it's just my, it's all, this all stuff is all subjective and it's my opinion. And I haven't calibrated this with scouting directors at this point in the cycle, but that's my thought, is like those two guys, I think, are considered the top collegiate bats, but I wouldn't put either of them ahead of like Christian Moore from last year, who went 9th overall. So somewhere in that next tier, you know, like Ike Irish hit 390 in the SEC, and that's nothing like that with like 13 jacks. And he's, when I saw him last year in the Cape, he was playing catcher specifically, but I was struck by like the lack of physicality. And I'm like, I don't know if that could hold up like 100 games behind home plate. This year he's been playing more in the outfield. You know, if a team thinks he can catch, then he belongs up there in that top 10. If he can catch and has that track record with the bat, if he's being used as an outfielder, you know, it's less special, but still, you know, it's still a first round talent. And I think he would be in that teens if we're talking about where he would be from last year. Yeah, for sure.
Well, if let's go ahead and say you're Mike Rizzo. Who are you taking number one overall in this draft?
So for me, again, with the caveat that I know very little about the high school guys, I take Cade Anderson, the left-hander out of LSU. And I didn't fully decide that until maybe last night when he struck out 10 in a complete game shutout in the College World Series Finals. But, you know, he's a 6'2 lefty who led the country with 180 strikeouts this year. Doesn't walk guys. He was up to 97 with his fastball. You know, there's not a Paul Skeens or even a Chase Burns or a Hagen Smith in this class, in my opinion. You know, it's that they're a tier down, just like we're talking about the hitters from last year. But he's still a guy who struck out, you know, more people than anyone in the country. He can land he gets a good whiff rate on his fastball, which is always an attribute that I like. You know, you got to be able to miss bats with your fastball, and everything else feeds off that. And then and then landing your secondaries for strikes. And he does that. He throws all four of those pitches at any time in the count. For me, the changeup is his best secondary. He's got like a 47% whiff rate on that. I don't think you're drafting him and saying he's a future ace. He's a Paul Skeens on your team. But if you draft him with as a number two, number three upside, you know, I would feel good about that at the number one pick on a draft class that, as we've established, is maybe a little bit down from prior years.
Yeah, I said it to both of you guys earlier. I think the Nationals are interesting because Mike Rizzo's been there so long that he's literally taken every demographic like in the top 10. Like he could,
right.
You know, he could take Seth Hernandez and I wouldn't be totally stunned, even though it's never happened before where like a prep righty's gone one. I mean, money factors in, they don't have extra picks. So, you know, this will start to come into focus. And both of you guys know, like I'd much rather take a bat than a pitcher that high. And I love prep guys. And I don't know how you don't take Cade Anderson at one. I just,
right.
You know, like no pitcher safe, right. There's no such thing as a pitching prospect, like all that stuff, but it's a 20-year-old lefty that looks this good, that has like youth on his side still and already had Tommy John. It doesn't mean he won't have another one, but like, that's kind of, you know, you don't really have to worry about that right away. And if he doesn't go one, he's going to be in the Angels bullpen like in 7 or 8 weeks.
Or whoever picks the Angels, whoever the Angels pick will be on their big league club in 7 or 8 weeks, I think.
Well, you kind of let the cat out of the bag with the next question that we were going to go to. But, you know, with Arnold and Doyle being the other two top left-handed pitchers, what is your thoughts on how you would tier those three pitchers in the draft?
And I do, yeah, I do think they're pretty close, but you know, as we've discussed, I would have Anderson first. And this could be a recency thing, but I went and covered the Knoxville regional a couple weeks ago in Tennessee, and Liam Doyle came out and he started on Friday and struck out 10 or 11 and then came back on Monday, got the win out of relief. And it was electric, like in pitching in a home environment. And the guy is like part psychopath in his DNA. And that's fun. Like, and it, you know, he's telling, you know, the opposing hitters that they're effed because they took a timeout, you know, and whether or not you could argue whether that's good sportsmanship or bad, but whatever. I'm there as a fan first and foremost, and I'm soaking in the environment. It was fun. But you know, that's not where you take a guy. Number one, that's not why you like a guy and you draft him. You do that for what his attributes are. And he struck out 42.6% of the hitters he faced this year. So that's why you write him a big check. Like the fastball has gotten up to 100. So it's more velo than the other two on this list that we're comparing him to. A 40% whiff rate on the fastball. We've talked about how I like establishing the fastball, and that's a pitch he'll throw 65-70% of the time. Like he truly works off that fastball and then mixes in the others 10-15% of the time. That workload that he pitched in the regionals might have impacted him in the supers, because he had kind of a less than stellar start against Arkansas, which was his second one in up to three. You know, it could be a head thing. You know, it's the second time in up to 3 or 4 weeks that he didn't pitch well against Arkansas, and Tennessee just hasn't played great a bit against them in the last few years. But you know, I think we're talking about guys who can get into a major league bullpen. Like, I think Liam Doyle could pitch in the bullpen in a major league team right now for anyone that would want or have the need to rush him and get him up there and get outs at the major league level. I think it's that type of stuff. There is some reliever risk, in my opinion, that more so with the other two guys. Like, I think, but I think it would be, if that's his floor as a high leverage guy, I'm not too sad about that. You don't want to take a guy who you think is just going to be a reliever if you're taking him second through 10th. In my opinion, you guys are giving me a face. Maybe
no, not you. We're looking at our comments here. Yeah. You're good.
Yeesh.
No, I don't see. I've been doing this long enough that I've seen Carson Fulmer pitch, and I don't get those vibes. But
no, yeah.
And then I would have Arnold third, and that's not a dig on him. You know, he struck out 17 in a game against Pittsburgh last year. That Pittsburgh's 3 hours from me in Columbus, and it was one. My schedule changes from day to day, hour to hour, and that was one of those games where I was getting ready to go to, and I decided against it, and I've been kicking myself ever since, because I would have seen him strike out 17 and got awesome coverage for that game, but I missed it. But you know, whereas the other guys on this list, I mean, Doyle had a couple struggles, but like Arnold had more pedestrian starts than those other two, including some down the stretch. You know, his best pitch is a mid-80s slider, and he throws it like almost 50% of the time. And it's a great pitch, but you know, I get the repertoire for him is only three pitches deep. These other guys go four pitches deep. That adds a little plus to them in my category. So, but the slider's really good. Guys are hitting like 160 against it. So I would throw it a lot too. So no offense intended there, but you know, that's why I would have him third, but I like all three of these guys.
Yeah, it's a true outlier fastball. So anybody that's not really worried about the delivery that thinks that they can develop secondaries, I mean, he's kind of a no-brainer. You know, this is interesting because this happens, I feel like, every year where pre-draft, like, or, you know, like preseason, right? Like, October, like, we think we know, right? And, you know, we'll get to the righties in a minute, but it was Arnold and Tyler Bremner of UCSB, right? So, like, were Anderson or Doyle even like on your radar coming into this season? Like, as far as, look, I know you knew who Cade Anderson was, right? But as like top five guys in this class.
No. And along with on those lines, not until Doyle, especially, start, like, he was getting insane numbers of striking out. Like, 80% of the guys he was throwing those first pitching against those first few starts. I obviously knew he had strikeout stuff from his previous two stops at Coastal and Ole Miss. But of these three guys, Arnold was the perceived top arm heading into the year because of that strong finish last year. Whereas these other two guys were more of the surging in their draft year compared to an Arnold, Jamie Arnold type of guy.
Yeah, so Bremner, we've obviously seen, like, had some struggles and then was pretty good, I think, down the stretch. And he was seen as the top college righty for a while, but then I think Kyson Witherspoon overtook him. But now there's another guy in Gage Wood. We kind of talked about him last week a little bit with Tyler Jennings. It was fresh off the no-hitter. Can he challenge Kyson to be the top college righty off the board, or are they both kind of, you know, maybe in that 8 to 20-ish range, I guess?
I think he could challenge him. I don't know if he has the full track record of like a Kyson Witherspoon to get up in that range. There are two other kind of college righties I like and I'll get to, but you know, I think Wood was maybe considered a second rounder until recently. It's his first year as a starter and he's missed some time, so he hasn't had that kind of full starter's workload and all that track record, that data and the reps that scouts have seen to say he belongs in that range. But the fastball metrics are pretty great on him too. They're up there with Doyle. But for Wood, I think the other pitches are more average in my book. So I don't have him quite up there with Witherspoon. I think Patrick Forbes of Louisville, and again, this is more my region. So, and I've talked to scouts who have seen him really good, seen him bad. Like when he's on, he's flashed ability to be in this conversation and be the top college righty. And another guy I really like is JB Middleton. I don't know if he's getting as much of the press. I will say, you know, when I saw him earlier in the year against Marshall, and there were only a handful of scouts there, but one of them was Mike Shirley. Now, that could be geographic. Like the times I run into Mike Shirley is because it's in my area. He lives in Southern Indiana, I think. And it's when the top guys are in town. And I'm sure it's a matter of convenience and he's doing his due diligence. But with that being said, Middleton was good when I saw him. And he's a three pitch guy. All three of those pitches, in my opinion, have a chance to be above average or better. Fastball got up to 98. It averages 94.1. The slider gets up to 91, but it's more effective when it's in that upper 80s range and it has more sweep to it, and it's a really good changeup. So, and then couple that with when I saw Witherspoon's one of these guys who has like elite fastball velocity. It averaged like 96.4 or something this year. I saw him against Kentucky, it was 95.2, and that might not seem like a lot, but that's enough where it's a little flat. Witherspoon's fastball is a little flat. It doesn't have it seems unfair to say it doesn't have the life of Chase Burns or Paul Skeens, but those are the top righties from the last two drafts, right? So when there's that 1 mile per hour difference against college hitters, like a team like Kentucky, who was in Omaha last year, they made him pay for it. So he wasn't able to establish that fastball and then get to the secondaries to put hitters away. So I didn't see Kyson Witherspoon on his best day. So that might close the gap with those other guys like Middleton and Forbes, who I've seen really good at times. So for me, like all four of those guys would be in a similar tier based on just what I saw, which is, you know, for most cases, it's a one start sample.
Ian, so MLB Pipeline has Middleton, Quick, and Forbes ranked 34, 35, 36. And I feel like any of those guys could go in the 20s to a good team. Just take college righties all the time.
I think so.
Speaking of righties, and this is something that James and I have talked about a lot. So Seth Hernandez is ranked, I think he's ranked number two by MLB Pipeline. Is there any shot that any of these college righties go above him just due to the NIL stuff that's been going on for the last couple of years, do you think?
I think that's another factor just to put in the equation. You know, it's something that scouts or prognosticators didn't have to think about 5 years ago, and now they do. Like, I didn't anticipate a guy like Tyler Bell would get to Kentucky last year as a second rounder, and you know, that's a school that's just only recently gotten super competitive and had that type of of NIL to get a guy like that to campus and keep him there for 2 years until he's draft eligible again. So those types of things, you know, I haven't heard of those types of things happening with this class yet, but that's where you start to hear those in the weeks leading up to them. The other factor, as you pointed out, like it's the Angels picking second, and I think they'll go college. I could see them surprising us and picking whoever they think can get up there quickly, or, you know, I really don't have a great feel for what they're going to do other than I would say I think they would lean college at two. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be shocked to see one of these guys get up there if they had that perceived safety due to a longer track record.
Yeah, as far as the right, I mean, I think Kyson Witherspoon could end up going higher than Seth Hernandez, but it would be like one of them goes seven and one of them goes eight, you know, that sort of thing. I will say, like, full disclosure here, like, I don't expect Seth Hernandez to fall further than 10, just based off of things I know and have heard. Like, I think the White Sox would just take him if he was there, and they'd pay him and figure it out, even if they want to take a hitter. And then the other thing that Burke just brought up about the NIL, and he's obviously covering the college game, and we're not privy necessarily to numbers and what these kids want and how much money they can get elsewhere. But I know it's affected the White Sox. I know that every year I go on a draft call and Mike Shirley, like, is puzzled at some of the asking prices for college guys who can just switch schools or whatever. I've heard the White Sox would love to be high school heavy in the middle rounds. And a lot of that has to do with, like, how much college guys are asking for. Like, if high school guys cost a little bit more, I think some teams will opt to just, like, try to pay a high school guy instead.
Yeah. And it's like, scouts can put a different dollar number on someone than an athletic director could. You know, there's value in a 23-year-old college veteran with 800 plate appearances under his belt that's not going to be overwhelmed by the situation, even if he's not a pro prospect. And that, you know, there's NIL value there, whereas, you know, the dollar sign that you might get on a pro pick is even greater, obviously.
Well, and I don't know, like, I don't know how much Tyler Bell got, right, to go there, but, like, he turned down, like, 1.8-ish million to go, you know, to turn pro with the Rays. So if you're him, right, if you can split the difference, and I don't know that these numbers are accurate at all. I'm just, like, if you could split the difference and get 900K and go to Kentucky for 2 years, well, I mean, yeah, that's probably a better deal, honestly. You go bet on yourself for two, like, you don't think you can come back out in 2 years and make the 900K? I think you probably can, which, you know, makes some of these fringy high school guys kind of difficult signs, like in the second and third round, like they used to be easier to sign, because a lot of these guys would just take $2 million, but that's the other end of it. Like, they might not anymore.
And the numbers I did hear about Bell, I won't disclose them because I have no idea if they're true, but they weren't quite that high, but they were in that same ballpark. And to your point, he had a great year. You know, he'd be batted second or first in that lineup, and the bat was kind of he was a glove first guy, and he hit well in SEC play. So, like, now he's going to enter next year, I assume, as a top half of the first round prospect, and potentially make more money than what he was offered last year, in addition to the NIL money that he's gotten over the last 2 years.
James, just to answer this question here, looking for a comp for Seth Hernandez, what you guys would think that,
I mean, I know that Burke hasn't seen him. I haven't seen him in person, obviously, but to me, it's very similar to your top high school guys that have gone up really, really high. Like, he's in the same tier as Jackson Job and some of those other guys that have gone that high. Like, I think, like, there's a strong argument that he's the best player in this class, but he's a high school righty. So, you know, like, do with that what you will. A high school righty's never gone one overall. You know what I mean? So I think he probably ends up down 7, 8, 9, probably doesn't get past Cincinnati. But if on draft night he's 3 to the Mariners and we're doing the show, like, I'm not going to be surprised at all.
That's fair. So we kind of already touched on the bats in this draft. But one thing that we were kicking around was, if Ava Arquette and Ike Irish were in last year's draft, where do you think that they're slotting in? Are they, you know, 10 to 20 range, or do you think that they could pop up a little bit higher?
Yeah, I think it would be in that 10 to 20 grand range, which we kind of alluded to, just based on how they would stack up or how I perceive their kind of future value to be compared to last year's class. So I would put them in that range rather than up in the top 10, like it's potential they could get picked this year.
Who's that next tier for you? Like the bats. I know you mentioned Merrick and there's like a whole host of other guys. I know Aloy is kind of risen his stock a little bit, I feel like. But there I think there's a group after those two.
Agreed. I kind of like Brendan Summerhill, the right fielder from Arizona. He's an athletic guy. There's potential he could maybe play center. They had a really good center fielder already there. But he played in center in the Cape last year. But a left-handed hitter, smooth, like runs kind of like a gazelle. He's high-waisted and long-legged. And a guy that I could see is like he's a slasher, leadoff hitter type guy who can steal a lot of bases. Devin Taylor is a guy I've always liked from Indiana. When you talk about like consistent track record, like that guy was the Big Ten Freshman of the Year 2 years ago, and it's just gotten better since then, and just stayed very consistent. Like there's not many weeks where you're just like, ah, Devin's not seeing the ball. The stats are always going to be there, and he's the all-time home run leader at a pretty good Indiana program that includes a lot of big leaguers, and he did it in 3 years. The knock on him is it's probably left field only. Like, and if the bat doesn't like it's left field only, and the two tools that you're paying for are the hit tool and the power. So if that doesn't work out, you're kind of out of options. But I think it'll work out. I think he's a tremendous kid who I've been able to cover a lot over the last 3 years. Luke Stevenson, I think the catcher from North Carolina. Again, if you think he can catch, and I've only seen him once, and I liked what I saw behind the plate, but I didn't see enough of a sample, I should say, to make the decision on whether or not I think he could play there at the pro level. But I really like the left-handed bat from him, so he's the guy I like. And then Merrick Houston is a guy I like really on both sides of the ball, who I think is like has a case for like being a top 10 player in this class.
Interesting. So one thing that with the White Sox, one thing that they are looking for is natural power. And one of the guys that has been talked about by White Sox fans for the last, I don't know, 6 to 8 months, and this season hasn't done a whole lot to solidify his spot in the draft, but Jace LaViolette, what is your take on his season and where do you think he's going to end up?
The first thing that stands out for him, and I even as a high school guy, I saw him kind of on the showcase circuit, is like the big physicality. Like he's a big 6'6", 230-pound dude, and the power really plays. Like it's at least plus power, potentially double plus power. He entered as the top guy or one of the top guys in this cycle after hitting 29 home runs last year, and he got off to a slow start, and then probably not coincidental, like the Aggies got off to a slow start. They were the preseason number one, and they got off to a slow start. Jace wasn't he was hitting like 230 a month into the season. Still wound up with like 18 home runs and a 1,000 OPS, but it was his worst of his three collegiate seasons. He played center field this year. He's probably a corner guy at the next level. I think he could play right field. He's got the arm for it. But yeah, like he's a guy that I wouldn't be shocked if he goes eighth or 28th on it. Like I don't know what the evaluators are going to make of the slow start, and like they're his worst tool is the hit tool. Like is it going to be like someone who's going to hit 220 and with 30 home run power, or can he get it up to 250 with some on base skills by drawing walks, and like that makes him way more serviceable as an everyday guy, right? So I would kind of bet on a guy who has that pedigree and entered the cycle. So like everyone would have taken him early last year if he was eligible, right? Like so that's not nothing. Was it just a rough start when all the eyes are on you and the pressure's on, like, I wouldn't ding a guy too much for that by bumping him to the second round. Like, he's still a first round talent in my opinion. So that's kind of my long-winded rambling answer of being like, I still don't know what I would do with him, but I'd bet on the talent is where I would lean.
Yeah, it's just a lot, you know, it's not even the strikeouts. It's like the in zone whiff and all. It's just, yeah, I mean, but if teams think that it's like an approach issue, right, I feel like they won't necessarily have a problem. We've been joking with guests, like, I kind of feel like he's a Baltimore Oriole. Like, I don't know that he gets to 19, but if he does, you know, I just
Colton Cowser type.
Yeah, yeah. They just take these. Who did they take out of? They took Vance Honeycutt last year. I mean, yeah. And Honeycutt's the better defender and center, but it's just a million strikeouts and it never translates. But yeah, they took Judd Fabian, right? So they're just not really afraid of this type of thing. I got to go back for a second, just on Merrick Houston. I know the White Sox are big fans of Merrick Houston. He's close to Winston-Salem, so I think they see him a lot. Like, how concerning, I guess, is it that, like, most of his home run production came early in the year, not in SEC play, and then obviously, like, a lot of it was at Wake Forest, like, at their ballpark. And he's a stud defender. He's gonna play shortstop, right? So, like, if he hits it all, he's probably a big leaguer. But just how much impact is it really? I know you're probably on the high end of that.
I am. Now, it helps that, again, he hit 3 home runs in the Knoxville regional. But Lindsey Nelson Stadium is pretty similar to the couch in terms of being a bandbox, an offensive ballpark. But it was also in regional play against good pitchers. So I give that some credit. The thing about Merrick Houston that I like that maybe alleviates some of that for me is, like, I liked him as a freshman when he started. Like, he's a glove. You pointed it out. He's a glove first guy. He batted 9th and played shortstop in 23 on that runner up team for Wake Forest, and I liked him then because you could tell the skills translated to the next level at shortstop. But yeah, he hit 220 with 4 home runs, and then this year it's like 15 home runs, 20 stolen bases, and a no doubt shortstop. So, like, that's why I like him so much. You know, I don't think it projects out as, like, plus power at the next level, but it alleviates some of that concern that you saw, is like, is this going to be a guy with an anemic bat that just has no punch to it? And I don't think that anymore, that you maybe thought after his freshman year. Like, he's gotten progressively better every year, so maybe you're saying, you know, that to me takes out that home ballpark factor of saying, as an offensive player, I like his ability to improve and get better and get him in a pro system and hope that can continue to develop.
So, I mean, it seems like we know you're you like him better than Vahiva Aloy and Gavin Keelan, but you think all three of those guys are shortstops and stay there?
I do. Keelan is, I like Keelan more than Aloy for his ability to stay at shortstop. And I, even though Aloy played there his whole career, like, Keelan started out playing, I think, second base at Louisville in deference to Christian Napchik. But even then, like, Dan McDowell at Louisville was like, you know, Gavin Keelan's a legit, no doubt, shortstop. So when he went to Tennessee, and not knowing as much about Dean Curley as I know now, like, I thought Keelan would be the starting shortstop for Tennessee all year long. It ended up being Dean Curley, and he was the starting shortstop on their national championship team last year, so I can't fault them too much. But Keelan, you know, Curley had some throwing issues, and Keelan ended up moving there. And Keelan, in my opinion, he's got the range, he's got the arm. Like, it was fun seeing him in the same regional as Merrick Houston, because I'm able to compare those two in real time. I like Houston better as a defender, but I think Keelan can play there long term. And Gavin Keelan, like, let's not forget, like, first month of the season, he was like a Golden Spike. He looked like a Golden Spikes Award winner. Then he got hurt a little bit. He came back, and he didn't get up to his full, his, he didn't return to form. It took him a while to, like, build up to playing at that level that he was playing the first month of the season, but he was, by the end of the year, like, he was one of their top 2 or 3 bats for Tennessee, and had a really good regional when I saw him. So I like him as my second best shortstop in that trio. And then Aloy, like, feels weird saying that. Aloy, the Golden Spikes winner and the SEC player of the year, I like him third best. Like, he's a fantastic player, had a fantastic season. 19 home runs, or 19 doubles, 21 home runs, 1,100 OPS. Again, played shortstop his whole career. And it might be recency bias, but that, God, that you guys see that play the other night where he, but the potential game-ending double play, and he gets the lead runner at third base, and then they go on to lose the game. And some of that's, you know, it's not all on him for sure, but that's still a puzzling, head-scratching play that you see from a guy who's a Golden Spikes Award winner. Like, but that's not why I wouldn't pick him above these other guys. To me, it's just he doesn't have that standout tool like those other guys do, in my opinion. He's pretty consistent across the board from a tool perspective, but I don't know if there's that one thing that you can say. Like Merrick Houston, I think, is a plus defender. Gavin Keelan, you know, is probably above average hitter, above average power, above average defender. Like, whereas Aloy, I would put like 50s on a lot of those tools, you know, like, and that's not nothing. That's not a dig at him. Like, it's just, I just don't think he's as tools. He doesn't have that standout tool like those other two guys do.
So Ian, Baseball America, I think it was Carlos, like, reported, like, in a mock draft, I think he had the Sox taking Billy Carlson, but, you know, he did say that they rolled heavy at that Tennessee regional, whatever that means. Right. I don't know if like Getz was there or whatever, like, to, and they know Keelan well, 'cause he was a Wisconsin prep, for Keelan. And then even for Andrew Fisher too. So Uncle Ted asked about Andrew Fisher. So did you see any of the White Sox people there, Burke? And also, like, touch on Andrew Fisher, please.
So your first question, if I saw the regionals, is weird for me. Like, and for the whole season, I go to these games and I don't even go up to the press box. Like, my preference is to bundle up in Midwest weather with my long underwear and sit with the scouts and talk to the scouts. For the regionals, I don't always have that option because they're packed SEC stadiums. Like, I can go to the University of Michigan or Ohio State and sit anywhere I want. Like, that's not an option I have when I go to Lindsey Nelson Stadium. So I had to sit up in the press box. So I wasn't able to take notes of who the scouts were watching them. But like, Andrew Fisher is a guy, that was the first time I saw him, and I was struck by the guy. Like, I talked to one scout about Andrew Fisher, who comped him to former White Sox Nick Swisher but that was more in terms of his gregarious personality. I don't know what was showing on TV, but like, at commercial breaks, that guy was basically like a cheerleader for the stands, and which rubs the opponent team the wrong way, and then he'll go and hit a home run. Like, he's got moxie, he's got swagger. Like, I like that dude. And he's a pretty good two-strike hitter. Someone can look up the two-strike. Maybe I'm wrong, but in my look, he was a good two-strike hitter. Like, the guy swings out of his shoes on every pitch. Like, I was impressed with how good of a two-strike hitter, with the fact that, like, he takes big boy daddy hacks with two strikes. Like, he does not let up. He's very competitive on a pitch-to-pitch basis. I love those guys who just grind out at-bats. And take it personally when they strike out. Like, he's a guy I would want on my team. And he's got real power that I think will play outside of ballparks other than just Lindsey Nelson Stadium. But yeah, it was the two strike swings is what struck me most about him. Like, him swinging out of his heels with two strikes and still looking to do damage. And I didn't see him swinging through like middle fastballs while he was doing that.
Ian, do you want to ask about, I think Jack asked about Ethan Conrad. He didn't ask. He said Ethan Conrad is being slept on.
Potentially, you know, it's, I saw him in the Cape. Did he come from Marist? Am I right about that? It was Marist to Wake Forest. Saw him on the Cape, and he was getting a lot of buzz as a potential first rounder. And I liked what I saw in the Cape. It's just, you know, when you're evaluating a guy in the Cape, you're not, your head's on a swivel when you're out evaluating players on the Cape. Your head's on a swivel. There's a lot of guys. I'm not fully digging in and like trying to evaluate where this guy is going to be next July during the draft. You like to just have that be your first look. You're taking notes and you're like, I see this guy. Here's what he's doing in the Cape again, and with wood bats against good pitchers. here's what I would like to see him do in the spring. And then he was doing well in the spring. And then once that goes down with an injury. So then it's like, you got to go back and recall like what you thought of him in the summer, when you weren't really trying to fully hone in on a guy. But like, I think if he didn't get hurt, he would be a first round pick because of like, there is that perceived safety in a guy who's hitting so well at the power five level, like he was this past year. And with the track record of what he did in the summer with wood bats, like that's always a big factor for evaluators. Had he not gotten hurt, I think he's in kind of that middle of the first round range. So I think it's a good point to say he's being slept on because of the injury. Like there's not that recent stuff that people can see, but on the other side of that coin, like these are all that's also when people start, they dig in so much on these players that they'll find warts that they might not have otherwise seen. And you're not going to see those, I guess, with Conrad, because there's not that recent performance you can try to pick apart. You can look back at how well he performed over the summer, which was great, and think optimistically about how that's going to project out. So I like him. I would put him in that kind of first round range, you know, seeing how things shake out. The same guy also that asked about Andrew Fisher talked about Boston Smith, who's a catcher at Wright State. And I've seen Mike Shirley at Wright State games, but he lives like 2 hours away from there. So, he's a guy who just in the month of May, like he was my preseason player of the year pick in the Horizon League. And then his numbers, like until May, were kind of pedestrian. Then he legit hit like 19 home runs in the month of May, broke their school's record for home runs, hit a couple against Vanderbilt in the Nashville Regional. Like the Duke can hit. He was a shortstop last year for Wright State. Now he's a catcher. I kind of like that profile. Like that's Dylan Dingler. Like you're athletic enough to play shortstop or other places, and then you get behind the plate. You know, he's not a Dylan Dingler. He's not going to throw out guys with a 1.85 top pop time. But I like that athleticism translating behind the plate in terms of blocking balls and stuff like that. He's a good player, good left-handed stick. He's a guy that I like, and I'm excited to see. They put in their third round in the comment, and I would love to see him get in that range.
There was a question earlier about Billy Carlson, whether it's possible that he slides to 10. You have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's possible for sure. I mean, so I think he's like the best defensive shortstop in the prep class. I'd have a tough time thinking that he's better than Merrick Houston defensively. So saying that he's the best defender in the class might be a little bit tough when Houston's been doing it at Wake Forest for 3 years. But he's also 19, which will deter some clubs, right? And like how many of these guys are going to go and like looking at it from the White Sox lens, right? And we're going to get into this in a second with Burke. Like I think they'd love one of these prep guys. But I mean, like are Holiday and Willits and JoJo Parker and Carlson all going to be gone by 10? Like if they are, somebody's on the board that you're not expecting, right? So I do think of those guys, it's why we keep hearing JoJo Parker and Billy Carlson, because I think one of them is probably there regardless. You know what I mean? Like right now, everybody's going, there's 15 players that are going to be off the board when the White Sox pick a 10 somehow, right? It's just somebody will be there. Yeah, Billy Carlson could be that guy. And I think the White Sox would be very happy with that.
Well, speaking of the White Sox and pick number 10, your thoughts on that, Burke, and who would you take?
Again, with the caveat of not being terribly familiar with the high school guys, I, as a White Sox fan, a suffering White Sox fan, I like them going high school. I like the idea of them going high school if they find the fit there. But in talking about the college guys that I like that could be available in that range, if Liam Doyle slide makes it there, I think that would be the end of his slide, or I would hope it would be, because I would want them to pick him. And then Merrick Houston, I think, you know, that might be the top of his range. I really don't know, but like I would like him at 10. Like I like that guy that much that I would draft him at 10 because of what he can do on both sides of the ball. I love guys when I see him in college, and there's just not a question whether or not he can play shortstop at the next level. And for me, that's him. And then with the progression that I've seen offensively, like that just makes him more appealing to me. But yeah. You know, I've lost my ability to be unbiased with Merrick Houston. I have too much affection for him that it was love at first sight when I saw him. And then he's done nothing to dispel that.
Do you think Brandon Summerhill's a definite corner? Or, I mean, obviously, like, you'll run him out at center, right? But I just feel like the offensive profile, if he's in center, right, and it's above average defense, like that really could boost him quite a bit. But if it's right field, I don't know. Like, the power potential, I kind of question a little bit.
The power would be atypical for right field, for sure. But right field is harder to play than left field. He's a good enough defender to play right field over left field. Like, he's not just saying you got to stick him in left field and then he's a 10 to 15 home run guy there. Like, I would love to see more. I saw him play a little bit in center last year. Actually, in the Cape Cod All-Star game, he was playing center field and ran face first into the wall, and they had to bring out an ambulance. Like, they stopped play for like 20 minutes to get him out of there. It was scary. But, you know, so that's like, you could say, hey, love the hard-nosed attitude, or you could say, is the spatial awareness concerning that he's running face first full speed into the wall? You know, like, I haven't seen truly just enough reps there, but like, seeing him run and seeing him take fly balls in right field, he looks good, getting good reads and stuff. So like, and he's athletic enough to just say, get in center and react, you know? But yeah, I would be concerned about if he can't play center and you have to put him at right field, 'cause he's not going to give you there's not a shot, to me, in my opinion, that 35 home runs is in his range of outcomes.
And then have you seen Cam Cannarella in person?
No, I haven't.
So with him, like, that's it. Like, he's just another one that, so he was supposed to be top 10 coming into the year. He had shoulder surgery. He struggled because of it, but he's so dynamic. I feel like the similarities between him and Mike Sirota last year to me, and now, of course, Mike Sirota is like well on his way to being a top 75 prospect in baseball because he's with the Dodgers, right? I think, like, a guy like Cannarella, if the league lets him fall to like the Dodgers or something, it's just gonna look it's just gonna look really stupid, because like, he very clearly played hurt. Like, just on my TV looks and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, he can't throw. It's like, well, can he not throw, or did he have shoulder surgery and now he's like playing and he probably shouldn't be playing, you know? So he's one of the guys in the college class to me that's fascinating, that I think could go in the second, and, you know, we're all 2 years from now like, oh yeah, he probably should have been in the top 15 like some of these other guys
did. Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. Like, there's always guys in the cycle, and the Dodgers always get one of them. But it's similar to my logic kind of on Jace LaViolette. Like, these guys were considered top guys for a reason. And if you're not seeing a troubling reason to pinpoint that fall off on, then I would still bet on the talent and just, you know, chalk up a less than stellar performance on playing through an injury, or you know, flukes happen too on your draft year. So I wouldn't let him slide too much if he was at once considered to be one of the top outfielders in the class.
Yeah, with the way things are this year, because there's just no guys that you say these guys are definitely heads and shoulders above everybody else, I wouldn't be surprised if guys from the second round from this year end up far outperforming some of the guys, and, you know, some of the top guys in the first round this year, just because it's not,
especially if there's a lot of high school position players getting picked, because their attrition rate is going to be higher. You know, there's going to be two or three guys that aren't going to hit. And if we knew who they were, then we'd be multimillionaires right now, but like, it's going to happen to a couple of them. And then, yeah, we're going to look at some of those college guys who got picked in the third or fourth round being like, God, why didn't that guy go in the first? And this high school guy did. But you could cherry pick those in every draft class if you're looking at it retrospectively.
So who are some of your Midwest guys that, you know, or some of these guys around here that you've seen this year that are personal favorites of yours that aren't necessarily like first rounders or top 40 guys?
That's a good question. One guy, we mentioned Boston Smith, is a guy that I liked, who really came on. there's a D2 arm from Ohio. I got to pull up his name. I want to say it's Logan Allen, but it's not Logan Allen. Gosh, sorry about this, guys.
Oh, you're good. I like the deep cuts, so
it is time. A deep cut. Like, I'm going to be the only
draft. We're asking the D1 baseball guy about D2 guys. So, you know,
I know
that's the problem. Yeah,
this is what, like, my bosses get mad when I go rogue and start going to games that are not in my wheelhouse. But this is a D2 arm who was throwing 100, and it was like an hour away from me, so I had to go. I had to go check it out.
Yeah, that's
Hunter Allen, a big right-handed D3 arm who was like up to 100, D2 or D3 arm. I can't remember what Ashland is. But I think he's like probably like a fifth or sixth round talent. Like, and he might be a reliever, but he starts for them. The game I saw, it was like he six innings, one hit, six walks, six strikeouts. Like, it's raw. He's got some work to do, but I like the potential, I should say, that I would draft him in the fifth, sixth, seventh round, or you know, for all I know, he has a year of eligibility and he goes to an SEC school and we're watching him pitch in the College World Series next year. Another guy, Mitch Voit, like, that's not too deep, but like in terms of a college position player, he plays second base for Michigan. His first year, he's their third baseman and closer. This is why I love college baseball. He's their third baseman and closer as a freshman. The next year, he's their right fielder and Sunday starter on the mound. He has a little arm thing this year. And the scouts that I had talked to liked him more as a pitcher in his underclassmen years than as a hitter. So he has arm surgery, and he's only going to hit this year. So I'm thinking he might be down on my draft list. And he goes out, and every time I'm watching him, he's barreling the baseball. So, like, he's probably hitting, like, 700 when I'm in attendance. And he's one of those Wisconsin prep guys. He was pretty highly touted out of that Wisconsin hitters, like, prep league or prep team. And I think the scouts really like him in my area. So I wouldn't be shocked if he goes higher than what he's showing on, like, the public boards. Like, because he looked really good at second base too, which is shocking. And you talk to Tracy Smith, Michigan's coach, and you're like, candidly, he said, candidly, I could put him at catcher and he'd be my best catcher. He's just that good. So he's a guy that I'm probably higher on than most of the industry too.
Interesting. So, I mean, I do like a draft notebook here, and in the latest one, I did like a 5-round White Sox mock draft, and I went very prep heavy just based off of like some of the things that I've heard. So I have them with Steele Hall in the first, which I think is kind of like a backup plan to some of these other guys. He's a 17-year-old reclass, you know, out of Alabama. And then I know for a fact, like Sean Gamble, he's an Iowa prep kid who transferred and played at IMG. He's been mocked in the first round, but I know the Sox would love, if they could get him to 44 somehow, I think that would make a lot of sense for them. And then Yuli Frenzler is a lefty high school kid out of Michigan who scouts have been in to see. But the last two guys who I was going to ask you about, so I've heard them linked to these guys. Nate Snead, I know you've seen, like, closing for Tennessee, obviously. Mm-hmm. Some people feel like he can start potentially at the next level, and then if he can't, then you just like put him right in the bullpen, whatever. But the other guy, Sam Horn out of Missouri. So he's only thrown like 15 innings in college. But so I remember this was a guy who was like this premium athlete starting pitcher who was like compared to Bubba Chandler all the way through school, like in Georgia as a high schooler. But he went to Missouri to basically play quarterback. And then he blew out and had Tommy John and missed all of 2024. And now he's back pitching for Mizzou. Like, my only question there was whether he was signable, and I don't expect you to know that, but just because apparently he's competing for the Missouri quarterback job. So, but that's another name who the White Sox like, apparently.
I don't know enough about Horn. with Missouri going, I think they went like 3-24 in the SEC. I didn't get with those three wins, I think being against Texas A&M, like, which is shocking because they're the preseason number one, but like I didn't get to see them. I did see Snead, and I've seen Snead a couple times, and he's one of those guys where you watch him pitch and you look at like, how is this guy not striking out a hitter an inning even? Like, because and I think I got my answer in a two inning appearance. Like, saw in the first inning, he made it through in like 15 pitches, seven of them were swings and misses. Like, and to your point, he was missing bats with four different pitches. Like, he's got four pitches that can play, so he's got a chance to start. And one of those is a fastball that was 101. So like, the dude, like, there's enough stuff that you can like. So I watched that. I'm like, well, what? And then the next inning, he walks the bases loaded, or he walks three, gives up an infield single on a bunt that he mishandled, and then walks in the winning run. So it's like I saw both sides of like the good Nate Snead and the bad Nate Snead.
Yeah.
To me, there's, I'm gonna bet on the talent, and what I saw in the first inning was more impressive than the second inning was disappointing. So for me, I'm like, I kind of like what's in the tank for this guy. And Frank Anderson's a Hall of Fame pitching coach for Tennessee, but like, I'm always like, what can a pro pitching coach, if they get in the right fit, bring out of this guy? And I think Snead is a guy. I think he could start. I think he's got a chance to start. And if a fallback being a guy who can let it fly and potentially get up to like 103 on the fastball, like this is a dude who can be a weapon. And if that's my fallback option, as a guy who can still bring it out of the bullpen like that, like, sign me up. If we're talking fourth and fifth round, especially.
Ian,
I could.
I think I read that he's a five pitch reliever. Maybe that's the problem.
I
It could
mean,
be, yeah, like.
with a guy like that, I could absolutely see him in Kannapolis, firing two innings and striking out five guys or walking five guys, So.
It's
To
like
your point, if you're a five pitch
Javier, yeah.
reliever who's,
Go ahead.
if you're a five pitch reliever who's not dominating, like, why not say, let's focus on these three best pitches and make that your repertoire and just shove it.
It would always drive me nuts when the White Sox traded for was it Javier Vasquez? And like, he's so talented and so
Yeah.
good, but it's like he's like, I have five pitches, and then he'd show them to the other team in the first inning. It's like, okay, well, like what are we doing here?
Yeah, 100%.
James, do you have any more for Mr. Granger here?
No, just
Yeah,
thanks. Thanks for joining us, and let everybody know where they can find you.
I have another Midwest guy that I
Okay.
when I whiffed earlier and couldn't think of one. Joseph Jurwa, out the
Michigan
six
State,
seven
yeah.
lefty starter out of Michigan State. He's a guy that I saw an opening weekend, and he got like 24 swings and misses in that game, which is top tier. And he's had a few of those starts. He was the Big Ten pitcher of the year, like, really good pitcher. He was a guy who was he got in the portal last summer and then initially committed to Vanderbilt, drew his name back, stayed at Michigan State, and won the Big Ten pitcher of the year. I love seeing that, because for all I know, he could have just been another guy at Vanderbilt. But in my mind, he's one of the top draft guys in my area. It was kind of a down year for my area. So like, if someone hands him in as a second or third round pick, like, I could see him, getting bumped up a little more, because the scouts are going to get a little trigger happy or antsy in the draft room when they don't have a guy from this area that they can nominate as a guy to potentially pick for that draft. So I could see him, if a guy saw him on the right day, he looked like a first rounder. So I could see him going in the second round.
Vandy could have used a guy like him this year.
They could have for sure.
All right. So, on the way out here, Burke, you want to let everybody know where they can find you and your work?
Yeah, I do a lot of stuff on Twitter, mostly player videos and statistical breakdowns, and all that is can be found on Twitter, Burke Granger, and then check us out on D1 Baseball. I greatly appreciate that they pay to send me out to all these great places and watch the game I love. So help support us, d1baseball.com.
Yeah, that's living the dream right there. That's good stuff. Yeah, thanks so much for hopping in tonight, Burke. We appreciate it. And I'm going to go ahead and walk us out here, James.
Hey, really quick. So Vince asked, it's outfielder Chris Young is the answer to that question for Javier Vasquez.
All right.
Sadly, I get both of those references and why they are relevant.
Yeah. Sad stuff.
I was a big outfielder Chris Young fan at one point in my life.
I mean, we've had hope for a bunch of the guys that have gotten traded out of here. So it always ends up like that. All right. You have been watching / listening to the Future Sox podcast. If you are listening to this in podcast form, know that you can find us every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on YouTube and the Purple app. You can also find this podcast along with all of our written content at futuresox.net. If you are looking for White Sox prospect highlights, you can find them on our X at Future Sox and also here on our YouTube channel. If you love the content and want to support us here at Future Sox, there's a link to our Patreon in our channel description and at futuresox.net. You can also toss up a super chat on our YouTube stream. Also, don't forget to like this stream and subscribe with notifications so you know when we're going live while helping us in the worldwide web algorithms. My name is Ian Eskridge at Daily White Sox. He is James Fox at JamesFox917. Thank you so much for your time, Burke. We appreciate it. We appreciate all of you in the chat. Thanks for coming and hanging out. Thanks for the questions. Thanks for driving the chat. Thanks for hanging out in the community. We appreciate you guys. We'll see you guys next week. Have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.
Looking to get the most out of your money, time, and even better, your points and miles? I'm Chris Hutchins. I'm a lifelong optimizer, and I've sold 2 companies, racked up millions of points, and traveled the world to over 60 countries almost always for free. And I host All the Hacks, an award-winning podcast trusted by more than 1 million listeners that turns big ideas into quick tactical moves you can start using today to upgrade your life, money, and travel. Recent episodes have covered how to book business class seats for economy prices, how to make an easy $3,000 a month from online deals, and tiny habits that you can use to buy back hours of your time each week. There's no fluff in the show. It's just proven playbooks to travel better, spend smarter, and design a life you're excited about. So search All the Hacks, that's All the Hacks, in your podcast app, hit follow, and start upgrading your life today.